From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Last night, the president raised doubts about the integrity of elections. A Michigan coalition says not true.
We just need to make sure the public is aware. It isn't that there are problems. It's that this year, because of COVID, it takes time to count those ballots.
Also, physical barriers between Grosse Pointe Park and Detroit have aggravated racial and social tensions over the years.
You know, their families told them that those barriers were there to keep us safe. You know, a lot of people call it the bubble, and it definitely was a bubble for so many of the kids I grew up with.
Is it time to take down all the physical impediments? And today, biologist Nizar Ibrahim talks about the dramatic dinosaur find he made in the Sahara.
It looks very, very different from other predatory dinosaurs like T-Rex, not just because of the giant sail on its back, but mostly because it had adaptations for life largely spent in the water.
That's coming up this hour. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, new research into dinosaur science that challenges what we know of land-bound species.
We always assume that they never really invaded the aquatic world. And so Spinosaurus is really changing that. And so it really forces us to fundamentally rethink our image of dinosaurs.
We'll meet the Detroit Mercy researcher who made the find in the Sahara later in the hour. But first, a word about last night's presidential debate. And yes, we are still calling it that. During the course of a 90-minute conversation, President Trump used the opportunity to raise questions about the safety and integrity of elections in November. You've heard on the show over the past few months from clerks in several Michigan regions and from state elections officials that they have no such fears. Their concerns at the moment are for producing results in a timely manner, for the most part. But we wanted you to know that a cross-partisan group of Michiganders has formed to recommend best practices for safe voting and hopefully safeguard the process. Barbara McQuaid is part of the team. A former U.S. attorney for Eastern Michigan, she is professor of law at the University of Michigan School of Law. Barb McQuaid, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So this project, Vote Safe Michigan, were there things that came up during primary season that stoked the group to action?
Well, the group has been working since before then. The idea is because of COVID, it seems likely that more people than ever are going to be concerned about going to the polls. And so rather than give up your right to vote, what makes a lot more sense is figure out ways to vote absentee safely. We have, by good coincidence, this new law in Michigan that voters passed by ballot initiative in 2018 that said you can now vote absentee for any reason or no reason at all. And so because we have that capability, we thought it was important to educate voters about how to take advantage of that law so that they can still vote without exposing themselves to COVID by going to the polls.
What sort of recommendations has the group been able to agree on so far?
Well, there are a number of best practices that exist. And luckily, here in Michigan, we have a Secretary of State who's an election law expert and who has adopted many of those recommendations. But, things like making sure that you have to sign the back of the envelope so that your signature can be compared with voter rolls as a way to avoid voter fraud. Using a barcode to track your ballot. So if you put it in the mail, you're able to check its progress and see where it's going. And expanding the locations where you can drop off your ballot. You know, there's been some concerns recently about delays in the mail. And if your ballot is not received by election day, it won't be counted. So in addition to recommending that people vote early, we've seen now the Michigan Secretary of State's office open all these little satellites around the country. Here in Ann Arbor, the University of Michigan Arts Museum is now a satellite where you can go and get a ballot and vote and put it in a drop box. In Detroit, they've opened 29 locations all around the city, including Little Caesars Arena and some other places. And so that, I think, is a really important part of this initiative, the opening of these satellite locations.
So I'm sure you're aware that in recent days, the Michigan House of Representatives has passed a bill that would allow for some more time for city and township clerks to prepare ballots for counting. And that's really what a lot of the clerks had been asking for, was that time to basically do the physical process of checking the voter signatures and removing the exterior envelopes, sort of pre-processing. At the same time, it looks like they still have some pretty clear guardrails. They'll have from 10 a.m. till 8 p.m. the day before the November election to pre-process. In your view, is that enough time?
Well, I think more time would be better, just to give them adequate time and get a better outcome. But I suppose to the extent the goal is accuracy and not compromising the outcome of ballots, you know, we don't want word to leak out that, you know, one candidate is way ahead or another, lest it discourage people from voting. And so I'm fine with it as long as people are also fine with the idea that we may not have a clear winner on election day. And I think that's fine. We just need to make sure the public is aware of that. And the lack of a clear winner on election day doesn't mean there's anything fraudulent or anything wrong. It just means it takes some time to count those ballots. And so, you know, more time up front would help enable that. But there are also, I think, security concerns about opening ballots before they're actually able to be counted. So I think that's a satisfactory response, as long as everybody has that understanding.
In your mind, what's the balance between delivering election results in a timely manner and delivering election results in a manner that reflects the will of the electorate?
Oh, I think delay is a small price to pay for ensuring accuracy. And so I think that if we don't have the outcome, I think Secretary of State Benson has said it might not be until, say, Friday before we get the results of an election week. I think that's okay. I think we just need to tolerate that. It's different from what we've typically had in the past in this country, with the exception of Bush v. Gore, when it took several weeks to sort out the results in that case because of how close things were in Florida. I think that we just need to make sure the public is aware of the reason for that. It isn't that there are problems. It's that this year, because of COVID, we may have a exceptionally higher number of people voting absentee, and it takes time to count those ballots. But I do think it's worthwhile to ensure that they're done accurately and to tolerate a little bit of delay. The election results aren't certified until something like December 19th anyway. And of course, a new president doesn't take power until January 20th. And so having a few extra days to sort through that, I think, is a small price to pay to ensure that the will of the people prevails.
There have been questions raised in recent days about whether the transition of power will go forward smoothly. President Trump has been cagey in suggesting whether he would or would not accept election results. Senator Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, has sort of poo-pooed it and said there's not going to be a problem. I want to ask how confident you are about a peaceful transition of power, whatever the election results may be.
I would feel a lot better about it if President Trump would say, of course, that there will be a peaceful transfer of power. We let the people decide and then we will follow their will. But instead, he says things like, we'll see what happens. And that does concern me a little bit. Now, I suppose, looking at in the light most favorable to his perspective, he doesn't want to commit to things until he sees whether there are irregularities, as we saw with Bush v. Gore, if he were to contest the results. And I think there could be some legal bases for that if there is some sort of impropriety. And so I would hope that that's all he's talking about, is that I don't want to commit to anything in the absence of knowledge. But the idea that a president would be soundly defeated in an election and then simply refuse to go, I hope, is a bridge too far even for President Trump.
As someone with some internal familiarity of the workings of the Justice Department, could you foresee a situation in which our systems of government have the sort of blunt force trauma that would accompany a refusal to leave office? And what happens if the Justice Department under Bill Barr tries to support the president's claim that election results are illegitimate?
I am a little concerned about that. You know, ordinarily, I would have said that's preposterous. The Justice Department follows the rule of law and is nonpartisan. But so many of the things that William Barr has done have appeared to me, at least, to be for the purpose of protecting President Trump and contrary to norms and normal practice, you know, favoring some of his allies like Michael Flynn and Roger Stone and spinning the Mueller report and things like that, that I don't have a lot of confidence in him. And the Justice Department does have some tools. It has the ability, even though state elections are typically state matters that would be resolved between either private parties or secretaries of state, the Justice Department does have the ability to file briefs called statements of interest in cases where there is a federal interest, and could bring the resources of the Justice Department to bear in that regard. I am hopeful that we won't see a complete breach of the rule of law. I think we're right to be a little bit skeptical, but I am hopeful that while William Barr may see his job as expanding the powers of the executive branch, that even he understands the difference between right and wrong.
I wanted to ask you about one more thing that came up in the debate last night. The Proud Boys President Trump referred to the Proud Boys when asked about white supremacist groups and told them, quoting here, to stand down and stand by. And that was received with a lot of consternation from a lot of people who have been watching alt-right movements across the United States. We know that there were about two decades there where law enforcement were not really taking alt-right groups terribly seriously as a threat to public safety. Do you think that that is still the case today?
Oh, I think that the FBI has said, the director, Christopher Wray, has testified that white supremacy groups are now the top terrorism threat. They are a domestic terrorism threat. This group, the Proud Boys, is a group of white nationalists. And I think calling upon them to stand by is deeply concerning, because I think even if President Trump later says, well, I never intended for them to do anything, this is a group that is foreign to combat what they see as extreme political correctness. And they may hear that as a call to action. And if President Trump is defeated in the polls, one could imagine them seeing this as their big moment. And so I thought that was incredibly irresponsible, beyond irresponsible, downright dangerous to call upon a group listed on the Southern Poverty Law Center's website as a hate group, to call them out by name, give them that sort of legitimacy, and ask them to stand by was really conduct unbecoming a president, really dangerous. I'd say even such an abuse of power as to be impeachable in a different time.
The president also called on his supporters to monitor the polls. We started talking about the safety of the vote. Is there a problem with more people, either Trump supporters or Biden supporters, being there in person on voting day?
Yes. And again, I think it's very problematic. There is a federal crime for voter intimidation. And to the extent he is asking people to show up at the polls to intimidate voters, that is a crime. I don't think that was what he was asking people to do, but what he says and what people hear may be two different things. To be a poll watcher, at least in Michigan, you have to get permission from the state to do that. Almost anybody can get it, but they don't want people just crowding out the polling place, especially during COVID, with people who are not there to vote or not in line to vote. And so if somebody wants to go through that process to be a challenger and they do watch polls just to make sure that everything is complied with and is done by the book, that seems fine. But the idea that people could just show up in mass at the polling place to show their support for President Trump, I think state election officials should and would put a stop to that.
Barb McQuaid, professor of law at the University of Michigan School of Law and former U.S. attorney for Eastern Michigan. Barb, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
In just a moment, a call from some Grosse Pointe Park residents to bring down all the barriers that divide the city from Detroit.
We've been trained in the points for generations to repeat these kind of, frankly, racist tropes about what these walls represent versus what they really are, which is to divide and to keep Black people out.
After the break, we'll talk with two activists working on issues of equity, freedom of movement, and race. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This week, we brought you a conversation about how public space and the built environment often ignores the needs of Black folks who live in those spaces. Today, we want to turn your attention to the physical barriers that block traffic routes along predominantly white and Black communities. Greg Donnelly has been a resident of Grosse Pointe Park since 2013. He grew up in Detroit. Bianca Garcia grew up in Grosse Pointe Park, and she now lives in Detroit. The two of them are part of a team that's been asking the points to continue a conversation about the barriers between their cities. Greg, Bianca, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
This subject has such a long story behind it. Could you describe for us the barriers that separate Grosse Pointe Park and Detroit as of today?
So the barriers that exist today have been constructed over mainly the second half of the 20th century, but continuing on into the 21st century over the last 20 years, there have been several actions by the administration of the city of the Grosse Pointe Park to add new barriers at the border that have been used to divide us, also as political tools and leverage for trying to push other agendas. Most recently, the city is actually planning to build another barrier along Mack Avenue at Weyburn, one block east of Alter. So right at the Detroit border, as part of a new development that moves the Department of Public Works building for Grosse Pointe Park from another location in the city to the edge of Detroit.
Bianca, tell us a little bit about the longer history. These barriers, where did they come from?
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, and it's really been proven just by lived experience, these borders come from racially motivated redlining on the Grosse Pointe Park side. So none of these barriers are put up by the city of Detroit or maintained by the city of Detroit. One is a fence. There's a couple of walls. And then there's also a traffic circle that only goes in one direction. There are other barriers to entry to public spaces as well. Our waterfront public parks and all of the Grosse Pointes are for our community only, even though they're public parks that are paid for by tax dollars. Instead of having them open, like, we're able to go to Belle Isle freely. We're able to go to all of the parks in Detroit, Dearborn, everywhere around us freely. You need a park pass that has a magnetic strip on it. You have to prove that you live there. And then there's even more discrimination against renters, who are also discriminated against socioeconomically and racially. And they have different access to the public parks than residents who own their homes do. There's plans in the works for there to be yet another wall at Weyburn and Mack, which is already blocked to car traffic. Now it's going to all block pedestrian traffic and get rid of a home and a community garden as well. So there are lots of residents in Grosse Pointe Park that are trying to bridge the two communities together, and we're continuously blocked by all of these barriers that are continuously being put up and maintained.
You know, I wanted to ask both of you how you each got involved in the push to bring down the barriers between these cities. You know, what makes you passionate about this? Bianca, could you start out?
Yeah, sure. You know, growing up in Grosse Pointe Park, I think I had a slightly different view on things than a lot of my classmates did. So I did a lot of my growing up in Southwest Detroit because that's where my dad's from. That's where my grandmother lived, my abuela. So I spent a lot of time in the city, and Grosse Pointe is known for having generations and generations of the same families living in the same neighborhoods, and they don't venture out much unless it's like to go to Somerset or something. So, you know, I would come to school every Monday and tell kids what I did over the weekend, and I would tell them I did something in the city, and it was like I told them I went on vacation. You know, their families told them that those barriers were there to keep us safe. Their families told them never to cross Mack or never to go too far toward the city on Jefferson. You know, a lot of people call it the bubble. And it definitely was a bubble for so many of the kids I grew up with. Hmm. Growing up and getting older, I just felt more and more strongly and strange about why it was such a clear border. It was as if it was another country that you just couldn't go over there. And the communities, you know, you couldn't walk one block into another community. So in the wake of the deaths of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, I had been attending the marches in Detroit, and I had done a couple of suburban marches, and I felt like it was such a moment that we had to call attention to the purposeful racial redlining that was going on in Grosse Pointe, not only just about bridging communities together, but also access to education, access to food and groceries, access to a responsive police force, a responsive fire department, like, you know, just access to the parks. So I organized the march to kind of broadly call attention to Black Lives Matter, but also call attention to the specific geographical and regional issues that are faced at the Grosse Pointe Detroit border. And along with Greg and also Frank Joyce, we wrote an op-ed about it, and we've been keeping an eye on you know, Grosse Pointe Park City Council and the Building Commission, and I think we're going to continue to do so because what's happening is just so clearly wrong, and we need to come together as communities.
Greg, what about you? What was your orientation to this?
Yeah, so I think most recently, I was actually inspired by the work that Bianca and others did to bring home to the points what's happening on a national and international scale with the protests that she organized earlier this year. As you mentioned earlier, I grew up in Detroit. I spent the first 28 years of my life there and then moved to New York City with my wife in 2008. And we came back home in 2013, and we were looking for a walkable place to live. And we landed in Grosse Pointe Park mainly because of that walkability. And we certainly weren't naive to the history between Detroit and the Points. I have an architecture degree from University of Detroit Mercy, and we studied actually in depth in college the history of this barrier.
You're telling me this was a case study?
Absolutely.
Wow.
People who are in architecture and design and urban planning schools from all over the world will study this border. And when we would have people visit from other parts of the world, they would ask us to look at two things. Like, number one would be the train station, because of that, you know, fabulous, you know, just sort of mythology around that. And then the second thing would be, we want to see the Detroit Grosse Pointe border or the Burwood Wall. Like, these are things that people know about internationally.
And the Burwood Wall is Detroit's wall separating white and black communities.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't naive to that when I moved here in 2013. However, knew many people who lived in Grosse Pointe Park, and particularly close to Detroit in Grosse Pointe Park, who were part of really positive things in the city and in the region. Then, just a few months after moving here, that first winter, the city of Grosse Pointe Park, using an excuse of a water main break on Kercheval, one of our main commercial thoroughfares that connects to Detroit, they used an excuse of a water main break to pile up snow and ice at the border. The following spring and summer, what had been a wall of snow and ice became a plaza that was sold to us as residents as a farmer's market, but really was a wall that actually had sheds placed literally across where the road was. And I started organizing with other neighbors who were really upset about this, you know, erection of a wall in the 21st century at the Detroit border. And eventually, as a result of our protests, as well as the administration in the city of Detroit at the time expressing their displeasure, they finally reopened one lane of traffic. And then years later, last year, actually, they reopened two lanes, but the roundabout, as they called it, which doesn't really function as a roundabout at all. But the sort of design issues of that aside, you know, for a couple of years, there was a lull in bringing attention to this and in trying to push the city of Grosse Pointe Park to do better. And then in 2019, we had a wave of new city council members elected who were very much supported by what we're seeing as a much more diverse and progressive population than I think a lot of the old guard in Grosse Pointe Park thought was there. And so there's this kind of battle between a culture around how things happen in Grosse Pointe Park, where people are more than happy to let the older white men make all the decisions for them,
mm-hmm.
and a newer way of thinking that's much more about including residents and how decisions are made. And we have an opportunity here to instead of being a model of what not to do, of how to heal those divisions.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Greg Donnelly, who's a resident of Grosse Pointe Park, and Bianca Garcia, who lives in Detroit. They both have history in both towns, and we're talking to them about the barriers between the Points and Detroit. I wanted to ask you both, this is definitely a moment where the world is paying a different kind of attention to systemic racism. And as we mentioned, Bianca, you were leading a march this summer. I wanted to ask both of you how you think the Black Lives Matter movement changed the temperature of the conversation in Grosse Pointe Park.
You know, as Greg said, the border at Grosse Pointe in Detroit is used in architecture and urban planning classes all across the world. When I went to the University of Toronto, I took architecture classes, and them, as well as Cambridge and Oxford, talked about that border.
Did you put your hand up?
Yeah. Oh, I did. I said, I'm from there, and I lived two blocks from this border, and you know, my professors were fascinated and wanted to hear more. And there's a lot of conflicting feelings about when did Black Lives Matter really start. And I feel like the movement really got started with the death of Trayvon Martin.
Mm-hmm.
Despite that, I think the new wave of Black Lives Matter activism that happened this summer has definitely sparked a new conversation around racial prejudices in the Grosse Pointes. Some of it has taken positive direction and some of it has taken negative direction. Grosse Pointe Park, despite all these borders being up, is kind of considered the most liberal of the Grosse Pointes. And, you know, in Grosse Pointe Park, you see a lot of Black Lives Matter lawn signs. You see a lot of conversation between neighbors and online about why this is important. I will say in the points overall, there's a lot of neutrality. There's a lot of all lives matter dialogue going on.
There's a lot of complacency too, don't you think?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I would say there's definitely a ton of complacency going on, especially with older residents and older, more visible residents that are involved in things like city council or just, you know, other city government.
Sometimes in various kinds of civil rights struggles, the thing that's hardest to overcome is the opposition that's not spoken. Have you two found that people are overt about their fears and their concerns?
There's definitely been concern, even from like the day of my march. I originally did not alert police that I was having the march because, you know, we were having people there that had had encounters with police that wanted to come and march. And I originally didn't want a police escort because we were marching on the border of the two cities. Both cities kind of insisted. And the conversation that I had with the Grosse Pointe Park police officer, he said, oh, you know, not all cops are bad. And, you know, this isn't that big of a deal. And we already know that Black Lives Matter. And we don't have to talk about this anymore. And it's not, I understand you want to organize this march, but, you know, not all cops are bad. And we understand that Black people's lives matter. And that's kind of it. And that was something that was really disconcerting to hear, especially from one of the police officers that was supervising this march, because our public safety officer should have training around why everything he just said was wrong and why they need to understand the Black Lives Matter movement. They need to understand why the use of excessive force is bad. They need to understand all of that. And they need to understand that, yeah, sure, not all cops are evil, terrible people, but the profession is inherently really flawed, and we need to do make a lot of changes and get a lot more input from the community.
Greg, go ahead.
So I think one of the things that we hear a lot is the borders make us safe, or they make us feel safe. And I think that a lot of the response that I hear is grounded in trying to change the conversation from these walls, whether they're a physical wall or a psychological wall at the border, to change it from something that's used to divide us to try and paint it as something that keeps people on the Grosse Pointe Park side safe from some imminent danger on the Detroit side. That one isn't true, and I think there's plenty of data to show that, but also you hear arguments like, well, you know, if somebody breaks into my house and they're running away, I don't want them to just be able to run into Detroit and get away and the cops not be able to get them. And, you know, I've literally had people say that to me. And my response is, well, what happens if the cop car is going down the street and the person jumps the wall? Like, then they've lost them, you know, and they'll never get them. You know, aside from my feelings about policing that I think align very much with what Bianca's talking about here. And the need to really have some major reforms and think much more broadly about what safety means. I think just for practical reasons, the argument of safety and having walls at the border is just not true. It's a falsehood. We've been trained in the points for generations to repeat these kind of, frankly, racist tropes about what these walls represent versus what they really are, which is to divide and to keep Black people out.
In the op-ed that you two wrote for Bridge Detroit with Frank Joyce, another community member who's been involved in this issue for a very long time, you sort of issued a public call out for people to come together and to start maybe bringing down some of the barriers themselves, that maybe this didn't have to be something that was imposed from above, but that Grosse Pointe Park residents could make change happen at the grassroots. Have you gotten any takers on that?
Well, we definitely have, you know, we have a lot of people active on Facebook, and there's actually pretty overwhelming support from people in Grosse Pointe Park and Detroit that want to attend and help out with an action that we're actually doing today, where we're going to place a bridge at the proposed site of the next wall at Mack Avenue and Weyburn. So we're expecting to see people from both communities kind of coming together in protest of all present barriers as well as the plans for the next barrier. You know, it is hard to navigate and hard to kind of figure out really concrete plans on how to go about once and for all taking these barriers down. But I think the more symbolic barrier of our communities joining together was really kind of reignited by this op-ed circulating. And I just see a lot of eagerness from all types of people from all different walks of life on either side, really feeling like what we said was resonating with them and, you know, that they want to take these barriers down as well. But it's really hard to figure out how to go about it. And, you know, we've been attending city council and building commission meetings, but our public comments are usually kind of snubbed or not really talked about, you know, by the councilors or the commissioners. But, you know, we're trying to do everything we can to finally eradicate all of these walls and all this stuff that's just blocking our communities from really actually joining together and becoming one.
Bianca Garcia of Detroit and Greg Donnelly of Grosse Pointe Park, I want to thank you both so much for your time talking to us about this today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Really appreciate you giving this the attention it deserves. Thank you.
Next up, stuff they don't tell you about at Dinosaur Summer Camp.
We sometimes face temperatures of, 120 degrees Fahrenheit, sandstorms, you know, there are scorpions and snakes.
A Detroit Mercy researcher featured in October's National Geographic magazine talks to us about digging for Spinosaurus in the Sahara. Stay tuned. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We live at a time when dinosaurs, one of the most captivating forms of life ever to appear on Earth, are being reimagined. The October issue of National Geographic magazine focuses on some new findings in paleontology, straight from the researchers who are making these discoveries. And among them, the work of Nizar Ibrahim is prominently featured. He's an assistant professor of biology at University of Detroit Mercy, and he's also a National Geographic Explorer. That's a grant program that Nat Geo extends to groundbreaking researchers in many disciplines. And he's with us now. Nizar Ibrahim, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The find that you made, discussed in the article, was found in North Africa in this place between Morocco and Algeria called the Kemkem. Obviously, today, this is one of the world's great desert ecosystems. But what did it look like 100 million years ago?
Well, it looked very, very different. And so this is actually one of the best places in the world to visit if you want to understand this concept of what we call deep time. So today, this is a hostile desert environment. But about 100 million years ago, this place was home to a huge river system teeming with life, including car-sized fish and giant flying reptiles and dinosaurs, of course. So it would have looked very, very different, like an alien planet.
The discoveries that you made are about the dinosaur Spinosaurus. We know that it was likely larger than a T-Rex with a sail along its spine. What's remarkable about Spinosaurus?
Well, the size of Spinosaurus is obviously impressive, but the most interesting thing about this animal is its anatomy. It looks very, very different from other predatory dinosaurs like T-Rex, not just because of the giant sail on its back, but mostly because it had a number of adaptations for life largely spent in water. So this was a river monster dinosaur, if you like. It was a dinosaur with dense bones, which are important in buoyancy control in the water, and a tail fin, a paddle-like tail that would have propelled this animal through the water. And that's a first in the world of dinosaurs, a giant predator going after prey in the water column. So that's really the thing that makes Spinosaurus so special and so exciting.
Can you tell us a little bit about how it's different, another dinosaur with the feature of a sail? I was thinking of the Dimetrodon, a land-dwelling dinosaur that really any school kid could probably identify, or the variety of Mosasaur recently found in Colorado?
Well, I have to burst a bubble here, or two maybe.
Please.
So Dimetrodon is not actually a dinosaur.
What?
Yes. It's an entirely different group of animals. In fact, Dimetrodon is more closely related to you and me than to T-Rex. So there are a number of extinct groups that are often mistaken for dinosaurs, and probably Dimetrodon is probably one of the most famous examples, but it's not a dinosaur. And yes, it did have a big sail on its back, but that's about the only thing they shared in common. As far as mosasaurs are concerned, mosasaurs also are not dinosaurs. They're marine reptiles. They're more closely related to things like lizards than they are to dinosaurs. And so we do know of marine reptiles like the mosasaurs or the long-necked plesiosaurs, which look a little bit like what people imagine the mythical Loch Ness monster to look like. We know that some of these animals, some of these groups took to the water and invaded the aquatic world. But dinosaurs are typically thought of as land-dwelling animals. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, there was kind of one of their biggest mysteries. You know, we know the dinosaurs dominated land environments, and we know that they took to the air. We know that birds are living dinosaurs, but we always assume that they never really invaded the aquatic world. And so Spinosaurus is really changing that. And so it really forces us to fundamentally rethink our image of dinosaurs. And so this is about more than just this one dinosaur. It's really challenging long-held beliefs.
The path that led you to the dig that yielded this incredible Spinosaurus find is a very long path. There's a really amazing story about how you found the man who would guide you to the site. I will not ask you to repeat the whole story because it's incredibly long, but can you give folks a sense of what factors did come together for you to forward the research in this way?
Well, the Spinosaurus research project was very challenging for a number of reasons. I mean, identifying the dig site, yes, that involved finding a local man who had found the first few bones of the skeleton. And it was a crazy detective story. And, you know, in some ways, luck was involved, but you kind of have to force this luck. You know, you kind of have to make things happen. You have to be very stubborn, which I can be. It really required a lot of determination and multidisciplinary research. I work with scientists from all around the world, from many different disciplines. And so resurrecting Spinosaurus was really a huge team effort. You know, it involved geologists, biorobotics specialists, you know, you name it. So it really taught me some very important things about modern science. You know, it's really, you know, multidisciplinary and very international. And it takes a lot of, you know, resolve and patience sometimes, and a little bit of luck.
Is the multidisciplinary stuff really a newer part of the work?
It is in some ways, because in some parts of the world, paleontology is still very much part of the earth sciences. The
geologic. Yeah.
But in places like the United States, you know, many paleontologists work in biology departments, including myself, or anatomy departments. You know, I'm teaching medical, you know, human anatomy with human cadavers to biology students and future health professionals. Right? Mm. So the next generation of surgeons and nurses and so on in Michigan have gone through my classes, at least some of them, looking at, you know, not just the human body, but a wide range of other vertebrates, which I think is very important. If you really want to understand the human body, you have to understand why it looks the way it does. And, you know, for that, you have to understand the evolutionary framework. But anyway, so I think in places like the US, paleontologists have been quicker, you know, branching out to their colleagues in, you know, using medical CT scanning technology, for example. And I think there was more multidisciplinarity in some parts of the world. Now it's pretty global. I think paleontology really has become a science that is also far more quantitative, you know, in that sense. Also, I think we've moved on from just kind of arm waving and making statements to having quantifiable data out there and really robust, statistically robust approaches and so on. So it is a big change. And I think paleontology was not all that multidisciplinary in the past, even though, I mean, by its very nature, of course, there's always a certain element of multidisciplinarity because it's animals, you know, it's biology and they're preserved in rocks, you know, so that's geology. But in terms of the tools we use and working across disciplines, I think, you know, this is really something that has changed quite a lot over the last 20 years or so. So it really is a revolution of sorts. You know, it's a very exciting time to be a paleontologist. It's still a difficult field to break into. You have to be really persistent, you know, you have to show a lot of perseverance, and you'll face a lot of challenges. You know, it's not easy to land one of these coveted jobs at universities or museums as a paleontologist. So it is a great time to be a paleontologist, but you know, we're still dealing with pretty limited funding. And many of these big discoveries you read about in the National Geographic magazine were done on a shoestring budget. So which is an interesting situation, right? Because the public is absolutely crazy about dinosaurs.
Right.
And a lot of money can be made with dinosaurs. They're traveling dinosaur exhibits with robotic dinosaurs. There are, you know, new Jurassic Park or Jurassic World movies coming out every few years, and they're all blockbusters. But then at the same time, the science that actually generates all of this information, you know, is chronically underfunded.
Yeah.
And we always have to look for alternative funding sources and so on. So it's an interesting situation. It's almost like, you know, dinosaurs are such a success story in the public imagination. And, you know, they are a success story, evolutionary speaking, but doing dinosaur science is pretty challenging and difficult. So I think one of the things that all the people featured in the Nat Geo article share is this perseverance and a passion for the field. If you don't have a passion for paleontology, you shouldn't do it. It's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nizar Ibrahim. He's an assistant professor of biology at Detroit Mercy, and his work is featured in the cover story of October's National Geographic magazine. It's called Reimagining Dinosaurs. Could you talk a little bit about the modeling that's most useful to you in your work? The story gives us just a taste of how you take the information on a dig and put it to use in the models that actually bring creatures back to life again.
Well, we can now harness modern technology in ways that we could not in the past. So I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, we now use CT scanning technology very widely in paleontology to look at the inside structure of fossils. We can figure out all kinds of things, from the brain anatomy of a dinosaur to cavities in the skulls that help them cool down their body temperature. And the example I just mentioned, biorobotics, involved building a model of a spinosaurus tail in a water tank. So we could actually quantitatively look at the performance of this fin-like tail I mentioned earlier on. And so, you know, we worked with a biorobotics expert. You know, he's mostly working on fish. And, you know, we introduced him to this new project and said, well, would you like to work on a dinosaur tail? You know, we're really branching out to all these other scientific fields and taking full advantage of the great possibilities that that brings. So, you know, CT scanning, biorobotics, you know, just the use of computers really has completely revolutionized paleontology in many ways. Also when it comes to handling very large data sets and so on. So it's a really exciting time to be a paleontologist, because it's no longer just about digging up bones and putting them back together. We can really, in some ways, breathe life into these creatures, really understand their biology, their ecology, their behavior.
What were conditions like on the dig in the Kemkem?
Well, conditions on the dig were brutal. That's actually one area of paleontology that hasn't really changed much in the last, you know, 100 years or so. There's still a lot of walking involved in hot, dry places, typically. So when we were out in the Sahara, it was really tough. You know, I brought a team of scientists and students out there. And it's very difficult to prepare people for the things they will experience there. You know, we were there in July in 2019, and it's obviously very hot in the Sahara in July. So we sometimes face temperatures of, 120 degrees Fahrenheit, sandstorms, you know, there are scorpions and snakes. You have to climb up these steep escarpments. I mean, it really takes its toll. And, you know, some of my team members were sick and a couple of them were hospitalized after one of our expeditions. I mean, you really push people to the limits. But at the same time, it's an experience of a lifetime. And so for my students, for example, you know, it was the hardest thing they ever had to do, but it was also one of the best things they ever did, you know, and they're still talking about that experience. So it's difficult to describe, you know, you're really pushing yourself to the limit. But it's, you know, you're kind of, you have a crazy adrenaline rush every day, you know, when you're finding new bones.
Were you among the members of the team that had to take medical treatment after the whole thing was over?
No, thankfully not. But on past expeditions, on, you know, working on other projects, you know, I think we all had medical, you know, health issues at some point. You know, some people sprain their ankle, others will be bitten by a venomous animal, others are, you know, heat exhaustion, or, you know, I mean, sooner or later, it's going to happen to you if you're working in these very challenging places. And not all paleontologists necessarily do that. You know, you can do amazing work just looking at specimens that are already housed in museum collections. But I always you know, I like the science, but I also really like the field work aspect, the, you know, kind of exploring virgin ground aspect of it, you know, really going out there and finding new things, especially in places like Africa.
It's clear, though, there are things that they don't tell you in paleontology summer camp.
No, that's the thing, you know, and actually, when I was putting together my very first expedition to the Sahara, I remember thinking, you know, there's no guide on how to put together an expedition. You know, there's no expeditions 101 course at university, right? So
yeah.
It's challenging. You have to figure it out from scratch, pretty much.
What aspects of the logistics are most challenging when you're out there? I mean, you pretty much have to provision for several dozen people, right?
Yes. I mean, water is obviously always a big concern. You have to bring huge quantities of water out into the field, you know, and different people have very different needs. You know, some people will drink the entire water supply for the day, you know, before noon, and others will last the day with just a couple of bottles. I mean, it's very interesting to see how different people are in that regard. So water is always an issue. It depends where you're doing field work. Sometimes we're lucky and we're in places where we can stay in local bed and breakfast places, and they will, you know, provide food and so on. And so, you know, we kind of have a base camp, as it were. But on other occasions, we're just out there in tents. And then, yes, you have to bring everything out there. And you can add to that other challenges which come with fieldwork in some places in Africa, like political instability or working in the border region between Morocco and Algeria, as we often do, where you need to get military permits and you have a military escort out there for your protection and so on. So those are all things that, you know, you don't learn at university.
Sure. What questions did this discovery on the 2019 dig answer for you about Spinosaurus? And what questions do you feel like you're needing to explore with your next few projects?
Well, that discovery was really, you know, a key moment for me, because it just showed without, you know, any shadow of a doubt that this was a water-dwelling dinosaur, you know, with a massive tail fin. And so all the other strange anatomical adaptations we had documented in this dinosaur before suddenly made sense. You know, the relatively short hind limbs, this animal clearly didn't spend much time on land, the crocodile-like snout, you name it, everything made sense. So, but of course, as is always the case with scientific discoveries, now we have a whole number of new questions. You know, how exactly did this animal move through the water? So we're planning to model the swimming patterns of Spinosaurus in detail using three-dimensional models, very sophisticated modeling approaches, and so on. So Spinosaurus is still going to keep us busy for a while, not just in terms of understanding the details of its biology, but also because I think there are still a few bones left to excavate at the dig site. So we will return at least, you know, one more time to the dig site. So, and in the bigger picture, I think Spinosaurus serves as a reminder that, yes, we live in a golden age of paleontology, but there are also many, many things we still don't know and understand about these animals. So in some ways, we're still scratching the surface, which I guess is good news for all the budding, you know, six-year-old paleontologists out there hoping to dig up dinosaurs one day. There's still plenty of hidden treasures to uncover.
Are there significant things about the fact that dinosaurs like Spinosaurus did enter the water that forward our understanding of the variety of species?
Well, I think one thing we're seeing very clearly is that dinosaurs were more complex, more adaptable than we previously gave them credit for. You know, we've kind of moved from this idea of these slow lumbering giants, you know, from the 1960s and, you know, earlier decades, to our modern image of dinosaurs as, you know, highly complex creatures, some of them living in big herds. You know, they invaded all of these different ecosystems. And I think fundamentally, we've moved from an image where we see dinosaurs as, quote unquote, you know, failures of evolution, to, you know, a huge success story in evolution. You know, calling someone a dinosaur should really be a compliment. If you're a CEO of a company and you're called a dinosaur, it should actually mean that you've been incredibly successful for a long time and adaptable. So I think we're really seeing a fundamental change in that regard.
Nizar Ibrahim is an assistant professor of biology at University of Detroit Mercy and also a Nat Geo explorer. His work is part of October's cover story for National Geographic magazine. It's called Reimagining Dinosaurs. Nizar, it's a delight talking to you. Thank you for making some time.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
And that's our show for today. Stateside is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. We get help from interns Catherine Newen, Nell Ovid, and Olive Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you Thursday.